Okay, in the last lecture, we were talking about saddle node bifurcations. Those are the first and easiest bifurcations that we're dealing with in this course. And what are the conditions for a saddle node bifurcation? Somebody tell me. How do we recognize a saddle node bifurcation? So an eigenvalue of the Jacobian matrix is equal to zero. Why is the Jacobian matrix important here? What is the Jacobian matrix? What does the Jacobian matrix tell us? Come on now. So the Jacobian matrix tells us what's happening to the vector field in the neighborhood of a steady state, and tells us whether trajectories are moving towards the steady state or moving away from the steady state. And the directionality of the movement is determined by the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix. So if all the eigenvalues are real negative numbers, then any perturbation decays away exponentially and comes back to the steady state. If some of the eigenvalues are complex conjugate numbers, then the real part of the eigenvalue determines whether the trajectory spiral into the steady state if the real part is less than zero, spiral away from the steady state if the real part is greater than zero. Okay, so that's why the Jacobian matrix is important. And at a saddle node bifurcation, before the saddle node bifurcation, at the saddle node bifurcation, one of the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix is equal to zero. So that means that small perturbations away from the steady state in the direction of that eigenvector associated with that eigenvalue, those perturbations are neutral. They don't, you can't tell whether they're going to come towards the steady state or go away from the steady state. Okay, so that's the condition of the saddle node bifurcation. Now, there's another way to phrase that condition. For an n-component system, for a state space with n variables, what's another way of phrasing the condition that one of the eigenvalues equal to zero, be equal to zero? That the determinant of the Jacobian matrix is equal to zero. That's the equivalent formulation of one of the eigenvalues being equal to zero. So we can recognize a saddle node bifurcation either way, either by looking at the determinant or by looking at the eigenvalue. So, we talked last time about tracking steady states as a function of a parameter. That's a one-parameter bifurcation diagram. And we pointed out that if we can find a steady state for a particular value of a parameter, then we can follow that steady state as the parameter is varied. And to do that, computationally, we use something called the implicit function theorem. The implicit function theorem allows us to track steady states as functions of a parameter. And we only run into trouble when the determinant of the Jacobian matrix gets small and goes to zero. Then we have trouble tracking the steady state, and that's exactly at the saddle node bifurcation. But we can use a little trick and get around that problem and follow steady states. And as we follow steady states, we find stable nodes can combine with stable saddle points at saddle node bifurcations. And we can locate those saddle node bifurcations. That's places where the determinant of the Jacobian matrix is equal to zero. Okay? And fortunately, we don't have to do this. The computer does it for us. There's very nice bifurcation software that will do all these calculations for us. It'll follow the steady states, and it will mark where the saddle node bifurcations occur. So that's a review of what we did last time. So today I want to pick up here on slide number 13 and talk about two-parameter bifurcation diagrams. How do we follow loci of saddle node bifurcations in two parameters? So what we want to end up with at the end of this exercise is a two-parameter bifurcation diagram. It's just a plot on the plane where we put one parameter on the x-axis and a second parameter on the y-axis, and the locus we want to plot is a locus of saddle node bifurcation points. And you'll see in a minute why this is very nice information to have. So, how do we define a two-parameter bifurcation diagram? Well, there are three conditions. For the case of a two-variable system, x and y, and parameters p1 and p2, that's the case I want to consider. But this is easily generalizable to any number of dynamic variables. So, what we need to accomplish, we want to follow a steady state, because a saddle node bifurcation is definitely a steady state, so we have to satisfy the two equations for the steady state, that f is equal to 0 and g is equal to 0. But we also have to make sure that this steady state is a saddle node, not just any kind of a steady state. We want it to be a saddle node, and at a saddle node, the derivative, the determinant of the Jacobian matrix, also has to be equal to 0. So we have three nonlinear equations to satisfy in four unknowns, the two variables x and y, and the two parameters p1 and p2. So three equations in four unknowns. And if it's an n variable system, we'll have n plus 1 equations in n plus 2 unknowns. Okay? And this is just the standard setup for the implicit function theorem. We just apply the implicit function theorem to find p2, parameter 2, as a function of parameter 1. And when you do the linear algebra, you get the matrix equation at the bottom of slide 13. So now we have the unknowns x, y, and p2 as functions of the parameter that we're varying, parameter p1. So we make a little change in p1, and we can follow the steady state x and y, and we can also follow the second parameter p2. And that will track the saddle node bifurcation. So here's what the result of these sorts of calculations look like in general on slide 14. At the bottom of the diagram, I've drawn a typical one parameter bifurcation diagram. So a variable x is drawn on the vertical axis, and the parameter p1 that we're varying is on the horizontal axis. And as we track the steady states, we see a stable node combining with a saddle point at a saddle node bifurcation at some unique value of parameter 1, P1 naught, I call that. And then the curve bends around and there's a second saddle node bifurcation, and then we get stable nodes above. And there's a region of bistability between those two bifurcation points. That's done at a particular value of P2. So I say the particular value of P2 is P2 naught. So I've drawn the one parameter bifurcation diagram for a particular value of P2. Above, I've drawn the two parameter bifurcation diagram, where I've put the second parameter on the vertical axis, and for that particular value, P2 naught, if I increase parameter P1, I move along a horizontal line, and you can see I hit first a saddle node bifurcation, and then a second saddle node bifurcation, and then P1 increases. And between these two saddle node bifurcations, the system is bistable, and outside, the system is monostable. Okay, so those are the conditions I have to start with. And the software will draw the one parameter bifurcation diagram, and the software will also leave little markings at the two saddle node bifurcations. Then you can go and grab the saddle node bifurcation points and ask the software to follow the saddle nodes in the second parameter. Okay? So if we start at the values P1 naught and P2 naught, grab that saddle node, and now follow the saddle node bifurcation, the software will start drawing this curve. And that's called a locus of saddle node bifurcations. It's also called a fold, a locus of folds, because the steady state surface folds over on itself at the saddle node bifurcation. So there's a fold locus that moves across the two-parameter bifurcation plane. Something funny happens up here at this point, and then the software will continue to follow the fold lines. Usually it'll be able to continue it and follow the other locus of saddle node bifurcation and pass through the other saddle node point that you found originally on the one-parameter bifurcation diagram. So generally speaking, when you follow saddle nodes, the generic kind of picture you get is the one at the top, where you get two lines, two fold lines, and those fold lines come together at a cusp, at a sharp point. And as a matter of fact, there's a nice theory that describes for you exactly the shape of these curves at the cusp point. The cusp point is called a codimension 2 bifurcation point. And the fold lines are called codimension 1 bifurcation points. So I might as well explain that terminology right now. A saddle node is a codimension 1 bifurcation. First of all, it's a bifurcation because it's a special value of the parameter. At the value P1 naught, something special happens to the dynamical system. What's special is the two steady states come together and disappear, and on the other side of the bifurcation, they're gone, okay? So there's been a qualitative change in the nature of the solutions of the differential equations at the bifurcation point. It's called a one-parameter bifurcation point because, in general, you only have to twiddle one parameter to find a saddle node bifurcation. And usually it doesn't matter which parameter you pick. Generically, if you twiddle that parameter, you can pass across the saddle node bifurcation and you can find it. Okay? So it only takes one parameter to find the bifurcation point. On the other hand, when we start following these saddle nodes, we see, like along this curve here, I can find those saddle node bifurcations either by holding P2 constant and increasing P1, I can sweep across there and I can find the one parameter bifurcation. Or I can hold P1 constant and increase P2, and I'll also cut across the fold line and I'll be able to find that saddle node bifurcation. But the cusp point, the point where those two fold lines come together, that's a codimension 2 bifurcation point. And I have to vary two parameters simultaneously in order to find that codimension 2 bifurcation point. And in some sense, the codimension 2 bifurcation point organizes the codimension 1 bifurcation. Okay? So the locus of codimension 1 bifurcations, the fold lines, emanate from the codimension 2 bifurcation. And this is going to be a general theme of these lectures. We want to characterize the types of codimension 1 bifurcations and then ask, how do those codimension 1 bifurcations fit together at codimension 2 bifurcations? And this is the simplest example. Okay, you with me? Any questions at this point? Okay, let's see what's next. So yes, Devashish.
Is the cusp point, the derivative of the function is just a complement goes to zero?
At the cusp point, there's a higher order singularity in the vector field, and more than one thing is going to zero at the same time, essentially is what's happening. But we'll talk more about that later. Okay, so I have a little footnote on slide 14 about how the bifurcation software auto actually follows saddle node bifurcation. And it doesn't do it by solving the determinant of the Jacobian equal to zero, because actually it's a pain in the neck to calculate the determinant of a big matrix. Instead, it uses the other criterion for a saddle node bifurcation, namely that the Jacobian matrix have a zero eigenvalue. And the condition that the Jacobian matrix have a zero eigenvalue is the second condition at the bottom of the slide. The Jacobian matrix times some vector Q is equal to zero. That says the Jacobian matrix has a zero eigenvalue, and Q is the eigenvector associated with that eigenvalue. But of course, this equation can have a trivial solution where Q is the zero vector, so we want to make sure Q is not a zero vector, that Q is a non-trivial vector, so we insist that the norm of the Q vector be equal to 1. Now, the reason this works is because we have a point where we know this is true. We assume we start with some place where we do know that Jacobian has a zero eigenvalue, and we know what the eigenvector is. It goes with that eigenvalue. So we have a starting place for satisfying those two equations. And now we just want to twiddle the parameter a little bit and make sure that we continue satisfying these two equations as well as the equations that insist that we be at a steady state. So actually, this is the way the software follows the saddle node bifurcations. Okay. So I want to switch gears now. On slide 15, we'll start talking about hop bifurcations. So saddle node bifurcations are bifurcations where steady states appear and disappear. Hop bifurcations are bifurcations where limit cycle oscillations appear and disappear. So let me begin by a simple example in two variables of how limit cycles are born at hop bifurcations, and then we'll try to generalize this idea. Prometheus, did you have a question? A limit cycle, I'll define in just a second, but basically a limit cycle is a periodic solution of differential equations. So it's not a steady state. At a steady state, nothing changes. Okay, a limit cycle is a periodic solution, so all the variables undergo periodic changes and then come back exactly to their starting point. That's a periodic solution. In a limit cycle is a periodic solution that has some stability property. So a stable limit cycle would be a periodic solution with the property that any perturbation away from the limit cycle, as you follow the perturbations forward in time, they should come back onto the limit cycle. So that's a stable limit cycle. In the limit as t goes to infinity, nearby trajectories come onto the limit cycle. Okay, then you can also define unstable limit cycles. It's a little more complicated. But I'll give you kind of a geometric picture of what a limit cycle looks like in just a second. So, yes?
A limit cycle is essentially there is no steady state, right?
There's no steady state on the limit cycle,
yeah,
for sure. The perturbation is, suppose you have a point on the limit cycle. So we have to assume, we're assuming we have a periodic solution to begin with, okay? So we have a point, and if we follow it forward in time, it changes, but after a time capital T, you come back to where you started, okay? So it's a cycle of states that repeats itself periodically with a period T, but not a steady state, okay? So then a perturbation away from the limit cycle is some sort of a push off the cycle. And for a stable limit cycle, for any small push off the cycle, you'll come back onto the cycle. Now, of course, when you think of it this way, then there's one direction in which you push that you don't come back. If you do a little push forward on the cycle or a little push back on the cycle, you'll stay on the cycle, but you'll experience a phase shift. So limit cycles are kind of neutral with respect to pushes along the cycle, and they're stable with respect to pushes off the cycle. Okay, all this is going to become clear as we develop the theory of limit cycles. But let's get a simple picture in two dimensions first, and then we'll see how to generalize this notion to any number of dimensions. Okay? So again, we start with a simple pair of nonlinear ordinary differential equations in x and y, and we can picture now the vector field on the plane, the phase plane. And the way to picture the vector field is by drawing the nulclines for the differential equation. So the x nulcline is the locus of points where f of xy is equal to 0. So this is where the derivative of x with respect to time is equal to 0. Along the x nulcline, there is no change in the x direction because dx dt is equal to 0. But there is, in general, a change in the y direction because dy dt is either positive or negative. So along the x nulcline, the vector field is vertical. It either points up or points down. And similarly, the y nulcline is the locus of points where g of x and y is equal to 0. So dy dt is equal to 0. There's motion in the horizontal direction, but there's no motion in the vertical direction. So we can begin to sketch out what the vector field looks like. Now, in this example, I have assumed that the x nulcline is a cubic-shaped curve, and I've assumed that the y nulcline is a vertical line. That's just to make things a little bit easier to see. But all the basic theory that we'll develop here is completely general. It doesn't depend upon the special case that I'm doing here. But this special case is nice, because now I take as my parameter p the location of the vertical nulcline, and as I increase p, the vertical nulcline moves to the right to larger values of x, and the steady state sweeps across the N-shaped nulcline, the cubic-shaped nulcline. And when the intersection is on the left branch of the nulcline, we have a stable steady state, and when the intersection is on the right branch of the nulcline, we also have a stable steady state. But when the steady state is on the central branch of this cubic-shaped nulcline, the steady state is unstable. And maybe you can see that from typical trajectories that I've sketched in here. If I try to follow the vector field, I have to spiral away from the steady state when it's on the intermediate branch of the x nulcline. And in this case, the bifurcation point where something special happens is when the steady state lies right at the minimum or the maximum of the x nulcline. And there, the vector field is such that it's not clear whether we're going to spiral in or spiral away from that steady state. So this is an example of a Hopf bifurcation, and if you look at the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix close to the Hopf bifurcation, what you will find is below the Hopf bifurcation, we have a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix, and the real part of the eigenvalue is less than zero, and that's a steady state that we call a stable focus. Because the eigenvalues are complex conjugates, there's an oscillatory part of the solution that looks like sines and cosines, and it tends to oscillate around the steady state with a characteristic frequency. But because the real part is less than zero, the magnitude of those oscillations is decaying away in time, like e to the minus real part of lambda times t. On the other hand, when we pass the bifurcation point and move to the other side, we still have a complex conjugate pair of eigenvalues, but now the real part of the eigenvalue is positive. And that means that the oscillatory part of the solution is tending to increase in amplitude with time. So we move away from the steady state in an oscillatory fashion, and that's called an unstable focus. And in these little diagrams on figure 15, I show you basically what the trajectories look like close to a stable focus and close to an unstable focus. And the question becomes, what happens right at the bifurcation point where the steady state changes from being a stable focus to being an unstable focus. What happens at that bifurcation point? It's a bifurcation point because qualitatively there's a dramatic change in the nature of the solutions close to the steady state. That's the definition, that's the hallmark of a bifurcation. But this is a very different bifurcation from a saddle node bifurcation.
Or another way to say that, where the sign of diagonal changes.
Well, at a saddle node bifurcation, we have a real eigenvalue, and it changes sign. It goes from being negative to being positive, so it passes through zero, or a real eigenvalue. At a Hough bifurcation point, we have a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues, and the real part changes sign. Okay? So they're very different kinds of bifurcations, although we recognize them in a similar way. Something is passing through zero. In this case, it's the real part of a complex conjugate pair that's crossing through zero. Okay? Now, what does the Jacobian matrix look like for this particular case? So this is slide 16. I'm just looking at the sign pattern of the Jacobian matrix. And if you just go back and look at the shape of the at the shape of the Mölk lines, you can predict what the sign of the Jacobian matrix has to be for this particular case. So I'll just do one example, and the rest of it you'll have to convince yourself of. An important example is the derivative of G with respect to Y. That's one of the diagonal elements of the Jacobian matrix. Okay? So here's the locus of points where G of X and Y is equal to zero. Now, what's the derivative of G with respect to Y? If I change in the Y direction, what happens to G? Nothing, right? Because it's a vertical line. So that's what's special about this particular example. Any little change in the Y direction causes no change in the function g of x, y equal to zero. So the partial derivative of g with respect to y evaluated at the steady state is equal to zero. That's what makes this example a special case, because this element of the Jacobian matrix is identically equal to zero. The off-diagonal elements have opposite signs, plus and minus, so there's some kind of negative feedback in the system. And the diagonal element with the derivative of f with respect to x, that's the one that we have to be concerned with. That's the important component of the Jacobian matrix. And the question is, what's the sign of the derivative of f with respect to x evaluated at the steady state? Well, we can use the implicit function theorem to figure out the sign of that partial derivative. So I'm just solving for the partial derivative of f with respect to x at the steady state, and I find that it's equal to the absolute value of f with respect to y at the steady state times dy dx. It's the absolute value because of the minus sign, and f sub y is a negative number. Okay? So that tells me that the sign of the diagonal component of the Jacobian matrix is the same as the sign, as the derivative of y with respect to x on the x Mölk line. So if we go back and look at the Mölk lines again, here's y as a function of x on the x Mölk line. It's that N-shaped curve, that cubic curve. And on the left-hand branch, the derivative of y with respect to x along the Mölk line is negative. So the sign of that component of the Jacobian matrix is negative. And then on the intermediate branch, the derivative of y with respect to x is positive because the curve is increasing, and then the derivative becomes negative again. So as the steady state changes from the left branch to the middle branch to the right branch, the sign of the diagonal component of the Jacobian matrix changes from negative to positive and back to negative again. Okay? Now, the next thing to point out is that the trace of the Jacobian matrix is the sum of the diagonal components. And since this is zero, the trace of the Jacobian matrix is just this component, the derivative of f with respect to x. So what's happening as we pass through the Hopf bifurcation is that the sign of the trace of the Jacobian matrix is changing. It's changing from minus to plus and back to minus again. And the hallmark of the Hopf bifurcation is that the trace of the Jacobian matrix is equal to zero. When the trace of the Jacobian matrix is equal to zero and the determinant is positive, then you have a complex conjugate pair of eigenvalues with real part equal to zero. Okay, so this is how you connect the nature of the eigenvalues and the sign of the real part to the elements of the Jacobian matrix. So let me just say it again, remind you, at a saddle node bifurcation, the determinant of the Jacobian is going to zero, and a real eigenvalue is going to zero. At a Hopf bifurcation, the trace of the Jacobian matrix is going to zero, and you have a complex conjugate pair with the real part passing through zero. And at the bottom of figure 16, I've tried to plot a locus of the determinant of the Jacobian and the trace of the Jacobian as functions of the parameter p, as the parameter p increases. So we start from a small value of p. The determinant of the Jacobian is always positive. We start with the trace negative, and then the trace becomes positive as we pass through the Hopf bifurcation, and then turn around and the trace becomes negative again. So we pass through two Hopf bifurcations, and in the intermediate region, the trace of the Jacobian is a positive number. Now the question is, slide 17, what happens when we're right at or close to the Hopf bifurcation point, the critical value of the parameter p where the trace of the Jacobian matrix is equal to zero? And that case is covered by Hopf's theorem. So Hopf's theorem says, suppose the Jacobian matrix has a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues, which we'll write as lambda is equal to r plus or minus I omega. So r is the real part of the eigenvalue, and omega is the imaginary part of the eigenvalue. And the eigenvalues are functions of the parameter, the bifurcation parameter. So as the bifurcation parameter p changes, the eigenvalue changes. The real part of the eigenvalue is a function of p, and the imaginary part of the eigenvalue is a function of p. And we are going to assume that there's a particular value of the parameter p sub h, the Hopf bifurcation point, where the real part of the eigenvalue is identically equal to zero. And furthermore, the derivative of the real part of the eigenvalue is positive, or at least non-zero. So that condition just says, as I change my bifurcation parameter p, there's a particular point p sub h where the real part is equal to zero, and as I change p, the real part of the eigenvalue changes. It doesn't just glance at r equals zero, but it actually crosses the real part equals zero. It's negative on one side and it's positive on the other side. That's called a transversality condition. It's quite a weak condition here. Okay? So those are the conditions for Hopf's theorem. There's one other condition I forgot to write down. all the other eigenvalues, right, because this might be an n component system, all the other eigenvalues, there's n minus 2 other eigenvalues, they all have real parts that are less than 0. So in every other direction, the system is stable. It's only changing its stability in the direction associated, or the plane associated with these complex conjugate eigenvalues. Okay? So, under these conditions, what Professor Huff proved was, for values of the parameter that are close to the bifurcation point, P sub H, so if the magnitude of P minus P sub H is sufficiently small, then there exists a one-parameter family of small amplitude limit cycles for one of the following three conditions. The limit cycles may exist for P greater than P sub H, in which case, since the derivative of R with respect to P is positive, if we go to P greater than P sub H, the real part would be a positive number, and the steady state would be unstable, okay, because now it would be an unstable focus, and in that case, the small amplitude limit cycles are stable. So as the steady state loses stability, stable limit cycles are born. That's one possibility. The second possibility is that the small amplitude limit cycles may exist for P values less than P sub H. In that case, the real part of the eigenvalues that determine the stability of the steady state, the real part of the eigenvalues are negative, and the steady state is a stable focus. And in that case, the small amplitude limit cycles are unstable. And that means that trajectories wind away from the small amplitude limit cycles and come onto the steady state, at least in some directions. Okay? And the final possibility is that these limit cycles exist only for the parameter identically equal to the bifurcation point, in which case the steady state is said to be neutrally stable, because if we push ourselves away from the steady state, no matter how far away, well, in the neighborhood of the steady state, if we push ourselves away from the steady state, we don't come back to the steady state, but we don't go away from the steady state either. Instead, we hop onto one of these small amplitude limit cycles and just spin around the steady state. That's the third possibility. Okay? Okay, this is a very elegant theorem. It's a little tricky to prove. I can't do it off the top of my head. You can find it in any number of textbooks and books on bifurcation theory. Some important things to notice. First of all, case number 3 is a very unusual case. We say it's not the generic situation. You have to satisfy very special conditions on the nonlinear functions f and g to get case number 3. It's easy to create examples of case number 3. It's just that they're not very robust. So I'll give you an example. A pendulum, a simple pendulum without any friction, is essentially one of these kinds of neutrally stable systems, and you can get small amplitude oscillations of any amplitude. But as soon as you put friction into the system, you destroy all those limit cycles and you just spiral down onto the steady state. Or as soon as you put a little energy into the system, you'll cause it to move away from the steady state. Okay, so it's not a robust situation. The robust situations are cases 1 and 2. But cases 1 and 2 are equally robust, and both cases are observed all the time. So you can't assume that just because there's a hop bifurcation, you're getting small amplitude stable limit cycles. It's just as likely those limit cycles will be unstable. Okay, Sandeep?
I'm responding to the case 2. If P less than PA, and then coming down, R is always
R is negative because of the transversality condition.
Our first function is R at P equal to 0, right? So when
yes.
P is less than PA, that means I'm on the left hand side.
You're on the left hand side,
yeah.
And the limit.
And always I'm going to have some unstable. Either stable point or I'm confused about that.
Okay, I think it might help if I show these diagrams on slide number 18. Okay, and then finally I'll get to your question. Okay. Okay, these complicated diagrams on the bottom of slide 18, they're classical diagrams that I tried to sketch out by hand that show you what's happening to these limit cycles as you move away from a Hopf bifurcation point. So they're complicated because I'm trying to draw it in three dimensions. I'm using a two-dimensional plane to show you the state space spanned by x and y, and the third dimension I'm using to change the parameter value, p. Okay? And in the case where you get stable limit cycles, as p increases, when p is less than the bifurcation point, so here you see the bifurcation point at p equal pH in the middle. For p less than pH, if you look at the state space, you're just spiraling into the steady state because it's a stable focus, okay? And when p is larger than pH, if you look at the state space, the steady state is unstable and you're spiraling away from the steady state and you're spiraling out onto this limit cycle. And the limit cycle is the closed orbit in the state space, okay? And now, as I get closer and closer to the Hopf bifurcation point, the amplitude of the limit cycles gets smaller and smaller, and the limit cycles squeeze down onto the stable steady state. And as a matter of fact, what Hopf showed in the proof of his theorem was the amplitude of the limit cycles looks like the square root of the deviation of P above P sub H. So actually, the envelope of the stable limit cycles forms a paraboloid kind of a shape in this case. So that's the picture that you have to see. This is called a supercritical Hopf bifurcation because the limit cycles appear for P larger than P sub H and they're stable limit cycles. And the envelope of the limit cycle is this paraboloid and the limit cycles are all attractors. They're all stable limit cycles. In the other case of a subcritical Hopf bifurcation, the paraboloid is flipped to the opposite side. And now, all of these limit cycles are unstable. On the inside of the paraboloid, trajectories are spiraling away from the limit cycle and towards the stable steady state. On the outside of the paraboloid, the trajectories are spiraling away from the limit cycle and going off somewhere. We don't know where because this is a local theory. We're just asking what happens close to the steady state. These trajectories that spiral away, they have to go somewhere. We'll worry about that later. Okay? So this is the picture that you should really be familiar with. And this is another famous question on preliminary exams. You know, what's the difference between supercritical and subcritical Hopf bifurcations? That's the picture I would want to see you draw. Okay, Tung Lee?
You mentioned in the Hopf theorem, you require all the other x-y parameters to be
yes.
Negative.
Yes.
Stable.
So you start from a perfectly stable steady state, right? Okay. Okay, so that's a very good question. What happens if one or more of the eigenvalues is already positive number or positive real part? And some other eigenvalues are complex conjugate pair and they cross the imaginary axis. The real part crosses through zero. What happens? So I'll tell you half the answer. Half the answer is you still bifurcate small amplitude limit cycles. Whenever a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues crosses the imaginary axis, you will bifurcate small amplitude limit cycles. What's the stability of those limit cycles?
Given some
Yeah, but I've already given you enough information to answer the question. They have to be unstable, right? So in the case where some eigenvalues are already positive, you know the system is unstable. And the limit cycles that are born have to be unstable because they're born from steady states that are intrinsically unstable. So you can get further bifurcations of limit cycles by Hopf's mechanism, but in those cases, the limit cycles are always unstable no matter which side they bifurcate on. Okay? Okay, let's just do slide 19 before we quit. So how do you locate a Hopf bifurcation? And what does a one-parameter bifurcation diagram look like? Well, you should have the hang of this now. We can follow Hopf bifurcation in one parameter by looking for places where the real part of an eigenvalue is equal to zero. So we have to solve, in general, n plus 1 equations in n plus 2. Oh, wait a minute. I'm doing a two-parameter bifurcation diagram here. There's a slide missing. How do we do a one-parameter bifurcation diagram? We're following the steady state in one parameter, and we just track the eigenvalues, right? That's what we did before. When we were following saddle nodes, we were tracking eigenvalues, and whenever an eigenvalue went to zero, that's where a saddle node bifurcation happened. In this case, for a Hopf bifurcation, you follow the steady state, you track the eigenvalues, and what you're looking for is a complex conjugate pair where the real part goes to zero, okay? And whenever that happens, the software puts a little marker at that point and said there's a Hopf bifurcation there. Okay? And then it just keeps following the steady state to see what other kinds of bifurcations there are. Now, then you can come back to that place where a Hopf bifurcation occurred and you can try to characterize that Hopf bifurcation. So one of the things you can do is you can track a locus of Hopf bifurcations in two parameters. So that's what I'm doing on slide 19. I'm drawing a two-parameter bifurcation diagram for Hopf bifurcations. Okay, so I have to satisfy that I'm on a steady state, and then I have to satisfy that a Hopf bifurcation occurred here. The real part of an eigenvalue is equal to zero. And then I can use the same arguments and draw a locus of Hopf bifurcation points. And typically what happens in these sorts of systems is that locus of Hopf bifurcations closes in a loop. This is not the only thing that can happen. We'll talk about more complicated situations, but this is a common case. In two parameters, the locus of Hopf bifurcations just closes in an egg-shaped region. And inside the egg, you have limit cycles, and outside the egg, well, that's a little complicated because it depends upon which side of the Hopf bifurcation the limit cycles are born on. Okay, so we'll have to deal with those sorts of details later. But for now, we can track a locus of Hopf bifurcations and find this egg-shaped region, and we'll expect to see oscillations inside the egg, but outside the egg, things may be a little bit more complicated. Okay, I think that's a good place to stop for today. Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot.